34. Sleep softly, my true love, and when you wake, this will be over, and I will joke you out of trying to learn details of the triste métier of war, and we will go to buy the little Negro or Moor, carved in ebony with his fine features and his jeweled turban. Then you will pin him on, and we will go to have a drink at Harry's and see whoever or whatever of our friends that will be afoot at that hour. We will lunch at Harry's, or we'll come back here, and I will be packed. We will say goodbye, and I will get into the motoscafo with Jackson and make some cheerful crack to the Grand Maestro and wave to any other members of the order, and 10 to 1, the way I feel right now, or 2 will get you 30. We will not ever see one another again. Hell, he said to no one, and certainly not aloud. I've felt this way before many fights, and almost always at some time in the fall of the year, and always when leaving Paris. Probably doesn't mean a thing. Who gives a damn anyway except me and the Grand Maestro and this girl? I mean, at command level. I give very much of a damn myself. But I certainly should be trained and adjusted by this time not to give a muck for nothing. Like the definition of a whore, a woman who does not, etc. But we won't think about that boy, lieutenant, captain, major, colonel, general, sir. We will just lay it on the line once more and the hell with it, and with its ugly face that old Hieronymus Bosch really painted. But you can sheathe your scythe, old brother Death, if you've got a sheath for it. Or, he added, thinking of Hurtgen now, you can take your scythe and stick it up your ass. It was Passchendaele with tree bursts. He told nobody except the wonderlight on the ceiling. Then he looked at the girl to see that she was sleeping well enough so even his thoughts would not hurt her. Then he looked at the portrait, and he thought, I have her in 2 positions, lying down, turned a little on her side, and looking at me straight in front. I'm a lucky son of a bitch, and I should never be sad about anything. 35. The first day there, we lost the 3 battalion commanders. One killed in the first 20 minutes, and the other 2 hit later. This is only a statistic to a journalist, but good battalion commanders have never yet grown on trees, not even Christmas trees, which was the basic tree of that woods. I do not know how many times we lost company commanders, how many times over, but I could look it up. They aren't made nor grown as fast as a crop of potatoes is, either. We got a certain amount of replacements, but I can remember thinking that it would be simpler and more effective to shoot them in the area where they detruct than to have to try to bring them back from where they would be killed and bury them. It takes men to bring them back and gasoline and men to bury them. These men might just as well be fighting and get killed too. There was snow or something, rain or fog, all the time, and the roads had been mined as many as 14 mines deep in certain stretches. So when the vehicles churned down to a new string deeper in another part of the mud, you were always losing vehicles and, of course, the people that went with them. Besides just mortaring it all to hell and having the fire lanes taped for machine gun and automatic weapon fire, they had the whole thing worked out and canalized so however you outthought them, you ran right into it. They also shelled you with heavy artillery fire and with at least 1 railway gun. It was a place where it was extremely difficult for a man to stay alive, even if all he did was be there. And we were attacking all the time and every day. Let's not think about it. To hell with it. Maybe 2 things I will think about and get rid of them. 1 was a bare-assed piece of hill that you had to cross to get into Grosshau. Just before you had to make this run, which was under observation with fire by 88s, there was a little piece of dead ground where they could only hit you with a howitzer, only interdicting fires, or from the right, by mortar. When we cleaned it up, we found they had good observation for their mortars there, too. This was a comparatively safe place. I'm really not lying, not me nor anybody else. You can't fool those that were in Hurtgen. And if you lied, they would know it the minute you opened your mouth, colonel or no colonel. We met a truck at this place and slowed up, and he had the usual gray face, and he said, Sir, there's a dead GI in the middle of the road up ahead, and every time any vehicle goes through, they have to run over him, and I'm afraid it is making a bad impression on the troops. We'll get him off the road. So we got him off the road, and I can remember just how he felt lifting him and how he had been flattened, and the strangeness of his flatness. Then there was one other thing I remember. We had put an awful lot of white phosphorus on the town before we got in for good, or whatever you would call it. That was the first time I ever saw a German dog eating a roasted German kraut. Later on, I saw a cat working on him, too. It was a hungry cat, quite nice-looking, basically. You wouldn't think a good German cat would eat a good German soldier, would you, daughter? Or a good German dog eat a good German soldier's ass, which had been roasted by white phosphorus? How many could you tell like that? Plenty. And what good would they do? You could tell 1,000 and they would not prevent war. People would say we are not fighting the Krauts, and besides, the cat did not eat me nor my brother Gordon because he was in the Pacific. Maybe land crabs ate Gordon, or maybe he just deliquesced. In Hürtgen, they just froze up hard, and it was so cold they froze up with ruddy faces, very strange. They all were gray and yellow like waxworks in the summer, but once the winter really came, they had ruddy faces. Real soldiers never tell anyone what their own dead looked like, he told the portrait. And I'm through with this whole subject. And what about that company dead up the draw? What about them, professional soldier? They're dead, he said, and I can hang and rattle. Now who would join me in a glass of Valpolicella? What time do you think I should wake your opposite number, you girl? We have to get to that jewelry place. And I look forward to making jokes and to talking of the most cheerful things. What's cheerful, portrait? You ought to know. You're smarter than I am, although you haven't been around as much. All right, canvas girl, the colonel told her, not saying it aloud. We'll drop the whole thing, and in 11 minutes I will wake the live girl up, and we will go out on the town and be cheerful and leave you here to be wrapped. I didn't mean to be rude. I was just joking roughly. I don't wish to be rude ever because I will be living with you from now on, I hope, he added, and drank a glass of the wine. 36. It was a sharp, cold, bright day, and they stood outside the window of the jeweler's shop and studied the two small Negro heads and torsos that were carved in ebony and adorned with studded jewels. One was as good as the other, the colonel thought. Which do you like the best, daughter?
I think the one on the right. Don't you think he has the nicer face?
They both have nice faces, but I think I would rather have him attend you if it was the old days.
Good, we'll take him. Let's go in and see them. I must ask the price.
I will go in.
No, let me ask the price. They will charge me less than they would charge you. After all, you are a rich American.
Et toi, Rambo?
You'd make an awfully funny Verlaine,
the girl told him.
We'll be some other famous characters.
Go on in, Majesty, and we'll buy the goddamn jewel.
You wouldn't make a very good Louis XVI, either.
I'd get up in that tumbrel with you and still be able to spit.
Let's forget all the tumbrels and everyone's sorrows and buy the small object, and then we can walk to Cipriani's and be famous people.
Inside the shop, they looked at the two heads, and she asked the price, and then there was some very rapid talk, and the price was much lower. But still, it was more money than the colonel had. I'll go to Cipriani's and get some money.
No, the girl said. Then to the clerk, put it in a box and send it to Cipriani's, and say the colonel said to pay for it and hold it for him.
Please. The clerk said, exactly as you say.
They went out into the street and the sunlight and the unremitting wind. By the way, the colonel said, your stones are in the safe at the Gritti in your name.
Your stones?
No, he told her, not rough, but to make her understand truly. There are some things that a person cannot do. You know about that. You cannot marry me, and I understand that, although I do not approve it.
Very well, the girl said. I understand. But would you take one for a lucky stone?
No, I couldn't. They're too valuable.
But the portrait has value.
That is different.
Yes,
she agreed.
I suppose so. I think I begin to understand.
I would accept a horse from you if I was poor and young and riding very well, but I could not take a motor car.
I understand it now very well. Where can we go now at this minute where you can kiss me?
In this side alley, if you know no one who lives in it.
I don't care who lives in it. I want to feel you hold me tight and kiss me.
They turned into the side street and walked toward its blind end.
Oh, Richard, she said. Oh, my dear.
I love you.
Please love me.
I do. The wind had blown her hair up and around his neck, and he kissed her once more with it beating silkily against both his cheeks. Then she broke away, suddenly and hard, and looked at him and said,
I suppose we had better go to Ares.
I suppose so. Do you want to play historical personages?
Yes,
she said.
Let us play that you are you and I am me.
Let's play, the colonel said. 37. There was no one in Harry's except some early morning drinkers that the colonel did not know, and the two men that were doing business at the back of the bar. There were hours at Harry's when it filled with the people that you knew, with the same rushing regularity as the tide coming in at Pont Saint-Michel. Except, the colonel thought, the hours of the tides change each day with the moon, and the hours at Harry's are as the Greenwich Meridian, or the standard meter in Paris, or the good opinion the French military hold of themselves. Do you know any of these morning drinkers? He asked the girl.
No, I am not a morning drinker, so I have never met them.
They will be swept out when the tide comes in.
No, they will leave just as it comes, of their own accord.
Do you mind being here out of season?
Did you think I was a snob because I come from an old family? We're the ones who are not snobs. The snobs are what you call jerks, and the people with all the new money. Did you ever see so much new money?
Yes, the colonel said. I saw it in Kansas City when I used to come in from Fort Riley to play polo at the country club.
Was it as bad as here?
No, it was quite pleasant. I liked it, and that part of Kansas City is very beautiful.
Is it really? I wish that we could go there. Do they have the camps there, too, the ones that we are going to stay at?
Surely, but we'll stay at the Muhlenbach Hotel, which has the biggest beds in the world, and we'll pretend that we are oil millionaires.
Where will we leave the Cadillac?
Is it a Cadillac now?
Yes. Unless you want to take the big Buick Roadmaster with the Dynaflow drive. I've driven it all over Europe. It was in that last Vogue you sent me.
We'd probably better just use one at a time, the colonel said. Whichever one we decide to use, we will park in the garage alongside the Muhlenbach.
Is the Muhlenbach very splendid?
Wonderful. You'll love it. When we leave town, we'll drive north to St. Joe and have a drink in the bar at the Rubidou, maybe two drinks, and then we will cross the river and go west. You can drive, and we can spell each other.
What is that?
Take turns driving.
I'm driving now.
Let's skip the dull part and get to Chimney Rock and go on to Scott's Bluff and Torrington, and after that you will begin to see it.
I have the road maps and the guides and that man who says where to eat, and the AAA guide to the camps and the hotels.
Do you work on this much?
I work at it in the evenings with the things you sent me. What kind of license will we have?
Missouri. We'll buy the car in Kansas City. We fly to Kansas City, don't you remember? Or we can go on a really good train.
I thought we flew to Albuquerque.
That was another time.
Will we stop early in the afternoons at the best motel in the AAA book, and I make you any drinks you want while you read the paper and Life and Time and Newsweek, and I will read the new fresh Vogue and Harper's Bazaar?
Yes, but we come back here, too.
Of course, with our car, on an Italian liner, whichever one is the best then. We drive straight here from Genova.
You don't want to stop anywhere for the night?
Why? We want to get home to our own house.
Where will our house be?
We can decide that any time. There are always plenty of houses in this town. Would you like to live in the country, too?
Yes, the colonel said. Why not?
Then we could see the trees when we woke up. What sort of trees will we see on this journey?
Pine, mostly, and cottonwood along the creeks, and aspen. Wait till you see the aspen turn yellow in the fall.
I'm waiting. Where will we stay in Wyoming?
We'll go to Sheridan first and then decide.
Is Sheridan nice?
It's wonderful. And the car will drive to where they had the wagon box fight, and I'll tell you all about it. We will drive up on the way to Billings to where they killed that fool George Armstrong Custer. And you can see the markers where everybody died, and I'll explain the fight to you.
That will be wonderful. Which is Sheridan more like, Mantova or Verona or Vicenza?
It isn't like any of those. It's right up against the mountains, almost like Schio.
Is it like Cortina, then?
Nothing like. Cortina is in a high valley in the mountains. Sheridan lays right up against them. There aren't any foothills to the Bighorns. They rise high out of the plateau. You can see Cloud's Peak.
Will our cars climb them properly?
You're damn right they will. But I would much rather not have any hydromatic drive.
I can do without it,
the girl said. Then she held herself straight and hard not to cry.
As I can do without everything else.
What are you drinking? The colonel said. We haven't even ordered yet.
I don't think I will drink anything.
Two very dry martinis, the colonel said to the bartender, and a glass of cold water. He reached into his pocket and unscrewed the top of the medicine bottle and shook two of the big tablets into his left hand. With them in his hand, he screwed the top back on the bottle. It was no feat for a man with a bad right hand.
I said I didn't want to drink anything.
I know, daughter, but I thought you might need one. We can leave it on the bar, or I can drink it myself. Please, he said. I did not mean to be brusque.
We haven't asked for the little Negro that will look after me.
No, because I did not want to ask for him until Cipriani came in and I could pay for him.
Is everything that rigid?
With me, I guess, the colonel said. I'm sorry, daughter.
Say daughter three times straight.
Hija, filia, daughter.
I don't know, she said. I think we should just leave here. I love to have people see us, but I don't want to see anybody.
The box with the Negro in it is on top of the cash register.
I know, I've seen it for some time.
The bartender came with the two drinks, frost cold from the chilled coldness of the glasses, and he brought the glass of water. Give me that small packet that came in my name and is on top of the cash register, the colonel said to him. Tell Cipriani I will send him a check for it. He had made another decision. Do you want your drink, daughter?
Yes, if you don't mind me changing my mind too.
They drank after touching the glasses very lightly, so lightly that the contact was almost imperceptible.
You are right,
she said, feeling its warmth and its momentary destruction of sorrow. You were right, too, he said, and palmed the two tablets. He thought taking them with the water now was in bad taste, so when the girl turned her head a moment to watch a morning drinker go out the door, he swallowed them with the martini. Should we go, daughter?
Yes, by all means.
Bartender, the colonel said, how much are these drinks? And do not forget to tell Cipriani I am sending him a check for this nonsense. 38. They ate lunch at the Gritti, and the girl had unwrapped the small ebony Negro's head and torso and pinned it high on her left shoulder. It was about 3 inches long and was quite lovely to look at, if you like that sort of thing. And if you don't, you're stupid, the colonel thought. But do not even think rough, he told himself. You have to be good now in every way until you say goodbye. What a word, he thought. Goodbye. Sounds like a Valentine slogan. Goodbye and bon chance and hasta la vista. We always just say merde and let it go at that. Farewell, he thought. That is a nice word. It sings well, he thought. Farewell, a long farewell, and take it with you where you go. With handles, he thought. Daughter, he said, how long has it been since I told you that I loved you?
Not since we sat at the table.
I tell you now. She had combed her hair with patience when they came into the hotel, and she had gone into the room for women. She disliked such rooms. She had used lipstick to make the sort of mouth she knew he most desired, and she had said to herself, making the mouth correctly,
"Don't think at all, don't think. Above all, don't be sad because he is going now."
"You look beautiful."
"Thank you. I would like to be beautiful for you, if I could, and if I could be beautiful."
Italian is a lovely language.
"Yes, Mr. Dante thought so."
"Grand Maestro," the colonel said, "what is there to eat in this Wirtschaft?" The Grand Maestro had been observing, without observing, with affection and without envy. "Do you want meat or fish?" "It's Saturday," the colonel said. "Fish is not compulsory, so I'll take it."
"It is sole," the Grand Maestro said. "What do you want, my lady?" "Whatever you decide. You know more about food than I do, and I like it all."
"Make a decision, daughter."
"No, I would rather leave it to someone who knows more than me. I have a boarding school appetite."
"It will come as a surprise," the Grand Maestro said, with his long and loving face, with the gray eyebrows over the softly hooded eyes, and the ever-happy face of the old soldier who is still alive and appreciates it. "Is there any news from the order?" the colonel asked. "Only that our leader himself is in trouble. They have confiscated everything he owns, or at any rate they have intervened. I hope it is not serious."
"We will have confidence in our leader. He has ridden out worse tempests than this."
"To our leader," the colonel said. He raised his glass, which had been filled with the decanted new and true Valpolicella. "Drink to him, daughter."
"I can't drink to that swine," the girl said. "Besides, I do not belong to the order."
"You are a member now," the Grand Maestro said, "por merito di guerra."
"I'll drink to him then," she said. "Am I really a member of the order?"
"Yes," the Grand Maestro said. "You have not received your parchment yet, but I appoint you super-honorary secretary. My colonel will reveal to you the secrets of the order. Reveal, please, my colonel."
"I reveal," the colonel said. "There are no pitted folk about?"
"No, he is out with his lady, Miss Baedeker."
"Okay, then," the colonel said. "I will reveal. There is only the major's secret that you must know. Correct me, Grand Maestro, if I fall into error."
"Proceed to reveal," the Grand Maestro said.
"I proceed to reveal," the colonel said. "Listen carefully, daughter. This is the supreme secret. Listen. Love is love, and fun is fun. But it is always so quiet when the goldfish die."
"It has been revealed," the Grand Maestro said. "I'm very proud and happy to be a member of the order," the girl said. "But it is, in a way, a rather rough order."
"It is indeed," the colonel said. "And now, Grand Maestro, what do we actually eat, without mysteries?"
"Some crab enchilada in the style of this town, but cold first. Served in the shell. Then sold for you and for my lady a mixed grill. What vegetables?"
"Whatever you have," the colonel said. The Grand Maestro was gone, and the colonel looked at the girl, and then at the Grand Canal outside the window, and he saw the magic spots and changes of light that were even here in the end of the bar, which had now, by skillful handling, been made into a dining room, and he said,
"Did I tell you, daughter, that I love you?"
"You haven't told me for quite a long time, but I love you."
"What happens to people that love each other?"
"I suppose they have whatever they have, and they are more fortunate than others. Then one of them gets the emptiness forever."
"I won't be rough," the colonel said. "I could have made a rough response. But please don't have any emptiness."
"I'll try," the girl said. "I've been trying ever since I woke up. I've tried ever since we knew each other."
"Keep on trying, daughter," the colonel said. Then, to the Grand Maestro, who had reappeared, having given his orders, the colonel said, "A bottle of that vino secco from Vesuvius for the small souls.
We'll have the Valpolicella for the other things.
Can't I drink the Vesuvius wine with my mixed grill?
The girl asked. Renata, daughter, the colonel said. Of course, you can do anything.
I like to drink the same wines as you if I drink wine.
Good white wine is good with a mixed grill at your age, the colonel told her.
I wish there was not such a difference in ages.
I like it very much, the colonel said. Except, he added. Then he did not continue and said, Let's be fresh, Rose, comme au jour de bataille.
Who said that?
I haven't the slightest idea. I picked it up when I took a course at the Collège des Maréchaux. A rather pretentious title, but I graduated. What I know best I learned from the Krauts, studying them and opposing them. They are the best soldiers, but they always overreach.
Let's be like you said, and please tell me that you love me.
I love you, he said. That's what you can base on. I tell you truly.
It is Saturday, she said. And when is next Saturday?
Next Saturday is a movable feast, daughter. Find me a man who can tell me about next Saturday.
You could tell me if you would.
I'll ask the Grand Maestro. Maybe he knows. Grand Maestro, when will next Saturday come? A Pâques ou à la Trinité, the Grand Maestro said. Why don't we have any smells from the kitchen to cheer us up? Because the wind is from the wrong direction. Yes, the colonel thought. The wind is from the wrong direction, and how lucky I would have been to have had this girl instead of the woman that I pay alimony to, who could not even make a child. She hired out for that. But who should criticize whose tubes? I only criticize Goodrich or Firestone or General. Keep it clean, he said to himself, and love your girl. She was there beside him, wishing to be loved, if he had any love to give. It came back, as it always had, when he saw her, and he said, How are you with the crow-wing hair and the break-heart face?
I'm a fine.
Grand Maestro, the colonel said, produce a few smells or something from your offstage kitchen, even if the wind is against us. 39. The hall porter had telephoned under the direction of the concierge, and it was the same motorboat that they had ridden in before. T5 Jackson was in the boat with the luggage and the portrait, which had been well and sturdily wrapped. It was still blowing hard. The colonel had paid his bill and made the proper tips. The people of the hotel had put the luggage and the picture in the boat and seen that Jackson was seated properly. Then they had retired. Well, daughter, the colonel said.
Can't I ride with you to the garage?
It would be just as bad at the garage.
Please let me ride to the garage.
All right, the colonel said. It's your show, really. Get in. They did not talk at all. And the wind was a stern wind, so that, with what speed the old calamity of a motor made, there seemed almost to be no wind at all. At the landing place, where Jackson was handing the luggage to a porter and looking after the portrait himself, the colonel said, Do you want to say goodbye here?
Do I have to?
No.
May I come up to the bar in the garage while they are getting the car down?
That will be worse.
I do not care.
Get that stuff up to the garage and have somebody look after it until you get the car down, the colonel said to Jackson. Check on my guns and pack this stuff in a way to give the maximum space in the rear seat. Yes, sir, Jackson said.
Am I going then?
The girl asked. No, the colonel told her.
Why can't I go?
You know very well you weren't invited.
Please don't be bad.
Christ, daughter, if you knew how hard I'm trying not to be. It's easy if you're bad. Let's pay this good man off and go over and sit on the bench there under the tree. He paid the owner of the motorboat and told him that he had not forgotten about the Jeep engine. He also told him not to count on it, but that there was a good chance that he could get it. It will be a used engine, but it'll be better than that coffee pot you have in there now. They went up the worn stone steps and walked across the gravel and sat on a bench under the trees. The trees were black and moved in the wind, and there were no leaves on them. The leaves had fallen early that year and been swept up long ago. A man came over to offer postcards for sale, and the colonel told him, "Run along, son, we don't need you now." The girl was crying, finally, although she had made the decision never to cry. "Look, daughter," the colonel said, "there isn't anything to say. They didn't install shock absorbers in this vehicle we ride in now."
"I've stopped," she said. "I'm not an hysterical."
"I wouldn't say you were. I'd say you were the loveliest and most beautiful girl that ever lived, any time, any place, anywhere."
"If it were true, what difference would it make?"
"You have me there," the colonel said. "But it is true."
"So now what?"
"So now we stand up and kiss each other and say goodbye."
"What's that?"
"I don't know," the colonel said. "I guess that is one of the things everybody has to figure out for themselves."
"I'll try to figure it."
"Just take it as easy as you can, daughter."
"Yes," the girl said. "In the vehicle without the shock absorbers."
"You were tumbrel bait from the start."
"Can't you do anything kindly?"
"I guess not. But I've tried."
"Please keep on trying. That's all the hope we have."
"I'll keep on trying." So they held each other close and kissed each other hard and true. And the colonel took the girl across the stretch of gravel and down the stone steps. "You ought to take a good one, not that old displaced engine boat."
"I'd rather take the displaced engine boat if you don't mind."
"Mind," the colonel said. "Not me. I only give orders and obey orders. I don't mind." "Goodbye, my dear, lovely, beautiful."
"Goodbye," she said.
40. He was in the sunken oak hogshead that they used in the Veneto for blinds. A blind is any artifice you use to hide the shooter from that which he is attempting to shoot, which in this case were ducks. It had been a good trip out with the boys, once they had met in the garage, and a good evening with excellent food cooked on the old open-hearth kitchen. Three shooters rode in the rear seat on the way to the shooting place. Those who did not lie had permitted themselves a certain amount of exaggeration, and the liars had never been in fuller flower. A liar in full flower, the colonel had thought, is as beautiful as cherry trees or apple trees when they are in blossom. Who should ever discourage a liar, he thought, unless he is giving you coordinates? The colonel had collected liars all his life, as some men gather postage stamps. He did not classify them, except at the moment, nor treasure them truly. He just enjoyed completely hearing them lie at the moment, unless, of course, something concerned with duty was involved. Last night there had been a fair amount of good lying after the grappa had been passed around, and the colonel had enjoyed it. There had been smoke in the room from the open charcoal fire. No, there were logs, he thought. Anyway, a liar lies best when there is a little smoke or when the sun has set. He had come close to lying twice himself, and had held it up and merely exaggerated. I hope, anyway, he thought. Now here was the frozen lagoon to ruin everything. But it was not ruined. A pair of pintails came suddenly from nowhere, slanting down fast in a dive no airplane ever made, and the colonel heard their feathered trajectory and swung and killed the drake. He lay on the ice, hitting it as solid as a duck can hit ice, and before he was down, the colonel had killed his mate, who was climbing long-necked and fast. She fell alongside the drake. So it is murder, the colonel thought. And what isn't nowadays? But boy, you can still shoot. Boy, hell, he thought, you beat-up old bastard. But look at them come now. They were widgeon, and they came in a wisp that coagulated and then stretched to nothing. Then they coagulated again, and the treacherous duck on the ice started to talk to them. Let them turn once more, the colonel said to himself. Now keep your head down and do not even move your eyes. They are going to come in. They came in well, with treachery speaking to them. Their wings were suddenly set to alight as when you lower the flaps. Then they saw it was ice, and they rose, climbing. The shooter, who was not a colonel now, nor anything but a gun handler, rose in the wooden barrel and got two. They hit the ice almost as solidly as the big ducks. Two is enough from one family, the colonel said. Or was it one tribe? The colonel heard a shot behind him where he knew there was no other blind, and turned his head to look across the frozen lagoon to the far, sedge-lined shore. That does it, he thought. A bunch of mallards that had been coming in low were flaring up into the sky, seeming to stand on their tails as they climbed. He saw one fall, then heard another shot. It was the sullen boatman shooting at the ducks that would have come to the colonel. How can he do that? The colonel thought. The man had a shotgun to shoot any cripples that might be escaping where the dog could not get them. For him to fire at ducks that were coming to the colonel's blind was, in shooting, as bad a thing as one man could do to another. The boatman was too far away to hear a shout, so the colonel fired at him twice. It is too far for the pellets to reach, he thought. But at least he will know that I know what he is doing. What the hell is this all about? On a beautifully run shoot like this one, too. This is the best organized and best run duck shoot I have ever shot at, and I have had as much fun shooting here as I ever had in my life. What is the matter with that son of a bitch? He knew how bad his anger was for him, so he took two of the pills and washed them down with a drink of Gordon's gin from his flask, since there was no water. He knew the gin was bad for him, too, and he thought, everything is bad for me except rest and very light exercise. Okay, rest and light exercise, boy. Do you suppose that is light exercise? You beauty, he said to himself. I wish you were here now and we were in the double blind, and if we could only just feel the backs of our shoulders touch. I'd look around and see you, and I would shoot the high ducks well to show off and try to put one in the blind without having it hit you. I'd try to pull one down like this, he said, hearing the wings in the air. He rose, turned, saw the single drake, long-necked and beautiful, the wings fast-moving and traveling to the sea. He saw him sharp and clear and in the sky with the mountains behind him. He met him, covered him, and pulled as he swung as far back as he could swing the gun. The drake came down on the ice just outside the perimeter of the blind and broke the ice as he fell. It was the ice that had been broken to put out the decoys, and it had refrozen lightly. The calling hen looked at him as he lay and shifted her feet. You never saw him before in your life, the colonel said to the hen. I don't believe you even saw him coming. Though you may have. But you didn't say anything. The drake had hit with his head down, and his head was under the ice. But the colonel could see the beautiful winter plumage on his breast and wings. I'd like to give her a vest made of the whole plumage, the way the old Mexicans used to ornament their gods, he thought. But I suppose these ducks have to go to the market, and no one would know how to skin and cure the skins anyway. It could be beautiful, though, with mallard drake skins for the back and sprig for the front with two longitudinal stripes of teal, one coming down over each breast. Be a hell of a vest. I'm pretty sure she'd like it. I wish that they would fly, the colonel thought. A few fool ducks might come in. I have to stay ready for them if they do. But none came in, and he had to think. There were no shots from the other blinds, and only occasional shots from the sea. With the good light, the birds could see the ice, and they no longer came in, and instead went out to the open sea to raft up. So he had no shooting, and he thought without intention, trying to find what had made it at the first. He knew he did not deserve it, and he accepted it, and he lived by it, but he sought always to understand it. One time it had been two sailors when he had been walking with the girl at night. They had whistled at her, and the colonel thought that was a harmless enough thing, and he should have let it go. But there was something wrong with it. He sensed it before he knew it. Then he knew it solidly because he had stopped under a light in order that they might see what he wore on his shoulders so that they might take the other side of the street. What he wore on each shoulder was a small eagle with wings outstretched. It was embroidered onto the coat he wore in silver thread, It was not conspicuous, and it had been there a long time. But it was visible. The two sailors whistled again. "Stay over there against the wall if you want to watch it," the colonel had said to the girl. "Or look away."
"They are very big and young."
"They won't be big for long," the colonel promised her. The colonel walked over to the whistlers. "Where's your shore patrol?" he asked.
"How would I know?" the biggest whistler said. "All I want is a good look at the dame."
"Do people like you have names and serial numbers?"
"How would I know?" one said. The other said, "I wouldn't tell a chicken colonel if I had."
Old army boy, the colonel thought, before he hit him. Sea lawyer, knows all his rights. But he hit him with a left from nowhere and hit him 3 times as he started to go. The other one, the first whistler, had closed fast and well for a man who had been drinking, and the colonel gave him the elbow in the mouth, and then, under the light, had a good right-hand shot at him. When it was in, he glanced at the second whistler and saw that he was okay. Then he threw a left hook. Then he put the right way into the body, coming up. He threw another left hook and then turned away and walked toward the girl because he did not want to hear the head hit the pavement. He checked on the one that had it first and noted he slept peacefully, chin down, with the blood coming out of his mouth. But it was still the right color, the colonel noted. "Well, there goes my career," he said to the girl, whatever that was. "But those people certainly wear funny pants."
"How are you?" the girl asked.
"I'm fine. Did you watch it?"
"Yes."
"I'll have bad hands in the morning," he said absent-mindedly. "But I think we can walk away from it all right. But let's walk slowly."
"Please walk slowly."
"I did not mean it that way. I meant let's not be hurried in our departure."
"We will walk as slowly as 2 people can walk."
So they walked. "Do you want to try an experiment?"
"Of course."
"Let's walk so we can make even the backs of our legs look dangerous."
"I'll try, but I don't think I can."
"Well, let's just walk then."
"But didn't they hit you?"
"One pretty good right behind the ear, a second boy when he came in."
"Is that what fighting's like?"
"When you're lucky."
"And when you're not lucky?"
"Your knees bend too, either forward or backward."
"Do you still care for me after you have fought?"
"I love you much more than before, if it were possible."
"Can't it be possible?" "It would be nice. I love you more since I saw that thing. Am I walking slowly enough?"
"You walk like a deer in the forest, and sometimes you walk as well as a wolf or an old big coyote when he is not hurried."
"I'm not sure I wish to be an old big coyote."
"Wait till you see one," the colonel said. "You'll wish. You walk like all the great predators when they walk softly, and you are not a predator."
"That I can promise."
"Walk a little ahead so I can see." She walked ahead, and the colonel said, "You walk like a champion before he is the champion. If you were a horse, I would buy you if I had to borrow the money at 20% a month."
"You don't have to buy me."
"I know about that. That was not what we were discussing. We were discussing your gait."
"Tell me," she said, "what happens to those men? That's one of the things I don't know about fighting. Shouldn't I have stayed and cared for them?"
"Never," the colonel told her. "Remember that, never. I hope they split a good concussion between them. They can rot. They caused the accident. There is no question of civil responsibility. We were all insured. If I can tell you one thing, Renata, about fighting."
"Tell me, please."
"If you ever fight, then you must win it. That's all that counts. All the rest is cabbage, as my old friend Dr. Rommel put it."
"Did you really like Rommel?"
"Very much."
"But he was your enemy."
"I love my enemies sometimes more than my friends. And the Navy, you know, wins all their fights, always. This I learned in a place called the Pentagon Building when I was still permitted to enter that building by the front door. If you like, we can stroll back down this street or walk it fast and ask those two that question."
"I tell you truly, Richard, I have seen enough fighting for one night."
"Me too, to tell the truth," the colonel said. But he said it in Italian, and it started, "Anch'io." "Let's go to Harry's for one, and then I will walk you home."
"Didn't you hurt your bad hand?"
"No, he explained. I only threw it once to the head. The other times I punched to the body with it.
May I feel it?
If you will feel very softly.
But it is terribly swollen.
There's nothing broken in it, and that sort of swelling always goes down.
Do you love me?
Yes, I love you with two moderately swollen hands and all my heart. 41. So that was that. And maybe it was that day, or maybe it was another that made the miracle. You never knew, he thought. There was the great miracle, and he had never consciously implemented it. Nor, he thought, you son of a bitch, did you ever oppose it. It was colder than ever, and the broken ice refroze, and the calling duck did not even look up now. She had abandoned treachery for an attempt at security. You bitch, the colonel thought. Though that is unjust, it is your trade. But why is it a hen calls better than a drake? You ought to know, he thought. And even that's not true. What the hell is true? Drakes actually call better. Now don't think of her. Don't think of Renata, because it won't do you any good, boy. It might even be bad for you. Also, you said goodbye. What a goodbye that was, complete with tumbrels. And she would have climbed up in the damn tumbrel with you, too, just so long as it was a real tumbrel. Very rough trade, he thought, loving and leaving. People can get hurt at it. Who gave you a right to know a girl like that? Nobody, he answered. But Andrea introduced me to her. But how could she love a sad son of a bitch like you? I do not know, he thought truly. I truly do not know. He did not know, among other things, that the girl loved him because he had never been sad one waking morning of his life, attack or no attack. He had experienced anguish and sorrow, but he had never been sad in the morning. They make almost none like that, and the girl, although she was a young girl, knew one when she saw one. Now she's at home and sleeping, the colonel thought. That is where she ought to be, and not in any goddamn duck blind with the decoys frozen up on us. I wish to hell she was here, though, if this were a double blind, and have her looking to the west just in case one string did come in. It would be nice if she were warm enough. Maybe I can trade somebody out of one of these real down jackets that nobody ever sold that had one, the kind they issued to the Air Force once by mistake. I could find out how they are quilted and make one with duck down from here, he thought. I'd get a good tailor to cut it, and we would make it double-breasted with no pocket on the right, and lay in a chamois shooting patch so the gun butt would never catch. I'll do it, he said to himself. I'll do it, or I will get one off some joker and have it cut down for her. I'd like to get her a good Purdy 21, not too damn light, or a pair of Boss over and unders. She should have guns as good as she is. I suppose a pair of Purdies, he thought. Just then he heard the light swish of pinions fast beating in the air and looked up, but they were too high. He only looked up with his eyes, but they were so high they could see the barrel and him in it, and the frozen-in decoys with the dejected hen, who saw them too, and quacked hard in her loyal treachery. The ducks, they were pintails, continued on their flight out toward the sea. I never give her anything, as she pointed out. There was the small moor's head, but it does not mean anything. She selected it, and I bought it. That's no way to give a gift. What I would like to give her is security, which does not exist anymore. All my love, which is worthless. All my worldly goods, which are practically non-existent except for two good shotguns, my soldier suits, the medals and decorations with the citations, and some books. Also a retired colonel's pay. With all my worldly goods I thee endow, he thought. And she gave me her love, some hard stones, which I returned, and the picture. Well, I can always give her back the picture. I could give her my ring from VMI, he thought, but where the hell did I lose that? She wouldn't want a DSC with cluster, nor two silver stars, nor the other junk, nor the medals of her own country. nor those of France, nor those of Belgium, nor the trick ones. That would be morbid. I better just give her my love. But how the hell do you send it? And how do you keep it fresh? They can't pack it in dry ice. Maybe they can. I must inquire. But how do I get that condemned Jeep engine to that old man? Figure it out, he thought. Figuring things out has been your trade. Figuring things out when they were shooting at you, he added. I wish that son of a bitch that is lousing up the duck shooting had a rifle and I had a rifle. We would find out pretty soon who could figure things out, even in a lousy barrel in a marsh where you can't maneuver. He'd have to come and get me. Stop that, he said to himself, and think about your girl. You do not want to kill anyone anymore, ever. Who are you feeding that to? He told himself. You going to run as a Christian? You might give it an honest try. She would like you better that way. Or would she? I don't know, he said frankly. I, honest to Christ, don't know. Maybe I will get Christian toward the end. Yes, he said, maybe you will. Who wants to make a bet on that? You want to bet on that? He asked the calling duck. But she was looking up at the sky behind him and had commenced her small, chuckling talk. They came over too high and never circled. They only looked down and went on toward the open sea. They must really be rafted up out there, the colonel thought. There's probably some punt gunner trying to sneak up on them now. They will be pretty close into the lee with the wind, and someone is sneaking onto them now, surely. Well, when he makes his shot, some may break back this way. But with it frozen up, I suppose I really ought to pull out instead of staying here like a fool. I have killed enough, and I have shot as well or better than I can shoot. Better hell, he thought. Nobody shoots better than you here except Alvarito, and he's a kid and shoots faster. But you kill fewer ducks than many bad and fair shots. Yes, I know about that. I know about that and why, and we don't go by the numbers anymore, and we threw away the book, too, remember? He remembered how, by some miracle of chance in a war, he had been with his best friend for a moment in the action in the Ardennes, and they were pursuing. It was early fall, and it was on a high upland with sandy roads and trails, and the trees were scrub oak and pines. The enemy tank and half-track prints showed clearly in the moist sand. It had rained the day before, but now it was clearing and visibility was good, and you could see well across the high rolling country, and he and his friend were glassing it as carefully as though they were hunting game. The colonel, who was a general then and an assistant divisional commander, knew the individual print of each tracked vehicle they were pursuing. He also knew when the enemy vehicles had run out of mines and approximately the number of rounds that remained to them. He also had figured where they had to fight before they reached the Siegfried. He was sure they would not fight at either of these two places, but would race for where they were going. We're pretty far up for people of our exalted rank, George, he said to his best friend. Ahead of the point, General. It's okay, the colonel had said. Now we throw away the book and chase for keeps. I couldn't agree more fully, General, because I wrote the book myself, his best friend said. But suppose they had left something there. He pointed to the logical place to defend. They didn't leave anything there, the colonel had said. They haven't enough stuff left even for a chicken shit firefight. Everybody's right until he's wrong, his best friend said, adding, General. I'm right, the colonel said. He was right, too, although in obtaining his exact knowledge he had not fulfilled the complete spirit of the Geneva Convention, which was alleged to govern the operation of war. Let's really chase, his best friend had said. There's nothing holding us up, and I guarantee they won't stop at either of those two. I didn't get that from any crowd either. That's from my head. He looked over the country once more, and heard the wind in the trees, and smelled the heather under their boots, and looked once more at the tracks in the wet sand, and that was the end of that story. I wonder if she'd like that, he thought. No, it builds me up too much. I'd like to get somebody else to tell it to her, though, and build me solid. George can't tell it to her. He's the only one that could tell it to her, and he can't. He sure as hell can't. I've been right over 95% of the time, and that's a hell of a batting average even in something as simple as war. But that 5% when you are wrong can certainly be something. I'll never tell you about that, daughter. That's just a noise heard off stage in my heart, my lousy chicken heart. That bastard heart certainly couldn't hold the pace. Maybe he will, he thought, and took two of the tablets and a swallow of gin and looked across the gray ice. I'm going to get that sullen character in now and pick up and get the hell to the farmhouse, or the lodge, I suppose that I should call it. The shooting's over. 42. The colonel had signaled the boatman in by standing up in the sunken barrel, firing two shots toward the empty sky, and then waving him toward the blind. The boat came in slowly, breaking ice all the way, and the man picked up the wooden decoys, caught the calling hen and put her in the sack, and with the dog slithering on the ice, picked up the ducks. The boatman's anger seemed to be gone and to be replaced by a solid satisfaction.
You shot the very few, he said to the colonel.
With your help. That was all they said, and the boatman placed the ducks carefully, breasts up, on the bow of the boat, and the colonel handed his guns and the combination cartridge box and shooting stool into the boat. The colonel got into the boat, and the boatman checked the blind and unhooked the pocketed apron-like device which had hung on the inside of the blind to hold shells. Then he got into the boat, too, and they commenced their slow and laborious progress out through the ice to the open water of the Brown Canal. The colonel worked as hard with the poling oar as he had worked coming in. But now, in the bright sunlight, with the snow mountains to the north and the line of the sedge that marked the canal ahead of them, they worked together in complete coordination. Then they were into the canal, slipping breakingly in from the last ice. Then suddenly lightborne, and the colonel handed the big oar to the boatman and sat down. He was sweating. The dog, who had been shivering at the colonel's feet, pawed his way over the gunwale of the boat and swam to the canal bank. Shaking the water from his white, bedraggled coat, he was into the brown sedge and brush, and the colonel watched his progress toward home by the movement of the brush. He had never received his sausage. The colonel, feeling himself sweating, although he knew he was protected from the wind by his field jacket, took two tablets from the bottle and a sip of gin from his flask. The flask was flat and of silver with a leather cover. Under the leather cover, which was worn and stained, it was engraved on one side, "To Richard from Renata, with love." No one had ever seen this inscription except the girl, the colonel, and the man who had engraved it. It had not been engraved in the same place it was purchased. That was in the earliest days, the colonel thought. Now who cared? On the screw on top of the flask was engraved, "From R to RC." The colonel offered the flask to the boatman, who looked at him, at the flask, and said,
"What is it?"
"English grappa."
"I'll try it."
He took a long drink of it, the type of drink peasants take from a flask.
"Thank you."
"Did you have good shooting?"
"I killed 4 dogs. The dog found 3 cripples shot by other people."
"Why did you shoot?"
"I'm sorry that I shot. I shot in anger."
"I have done that myself sometimes," the colonel thought, and did not ask him what the anger was about.
"I'm sorry they did not fly better."
"Shit," the colonel said. "That's the way things go." The colonel was watching the movement the dog made in the high grass and sedge. Suddenly he saw him stop. He was quite still. Then he pounced. It was a high leap and a dive forward and down. "He has a cripple," he said to the boatman.
"Bobby,"
the boatman called.
"Bring, bring."
The sedge moved and the dog came out with a mallard drake in his jaws. The gray-white neck and the green head were swaying up and down as a snake's might move. It was a movement without hope. The boatman put the boat in sharp for shore. "I'll take him," the colonel said. "Bobby!" He took the duck from the dog's light-holding mouth and felt him intact and sound and beautiful to hold, and with his heart beating and his captured, hopeless eyes. He looked at him carefully, gentling him as you might gentle a horse. "He's only wing-tipped," he said. "We'll keep him for a collar or to turn loose in the spring. Here, take him and put him in the sack with the hen." The boatman took him carefully and put him in the burlap bag that was under the bow. The colonel heard the hen speak to him. "Or maybe she's protesting," he thought. He could not understand duck talk through a burlap bag. "Take a shot of this," he said to the boatman. "It's damned cold today." The boatman took the flask and drank deeply again. "Thank you," he said. "Your grappa is very, very good." 43. At the landing, before the long, low stone house by the side of the canal, there were ducks laid out on the ground in rows. They were laid in groups that were never of the same number. There were a few platoons, no companies, and, the colonel thought, "I barely have a squad." The head gamekeeper was standing on the bank in his high boots, his short jacket, and his pushed-back old felt hat, and he looked critically at the number of ducks on the bow of the boat as they came along shore. "It was frozen up at our post," the colonel said.
"I suspected so," the head keeper said. "I'm sorry. It wasn't supposed to be the base post."
"Who was top gun?"
"The Baron killed 42. There was a little current there that kept it open for a while. You probably did not hear the shooting because it was against the wind."
"Where is everyone?"
"They're all gone except the Baron, who is waiting for you. Your driver is asleep in the house."
"He would be," the colonel said.
"Spread those out properly,"
the headkeeper told the boatman, who was a gamekeeper too.
"I want to put them in the game book." "There is one greenhead drake in the bag who is only wing-tipped." "Good. I will take good care of him."
"I will go inside and see the Baron. I'll see you later."
"You must get warm," the headkeeper said. "It's been a bitter day, my colonel."
The colonel started to walk toward the door of the house. "I'll see you later," he said to the boatman.
"Yes, my colonel,"
the boatman said. Alvarito, the Baron, was standing by the open fire in the middle of the room. He smiled his shy smile and said in his low-pitched voice,
"I am sorry you did not have better shooting."
"We froze up completely. I enjoyed what there was very much."
"Are you very cold?"
"Not too cold.
We can have something to eat."
"Thank you, I'm not hungry. Have you eaten?"
"Yes. The others went on, and I let them take my car. Can you give me a lift to La Tisana, or just above? I can get transportation from there."
"Of course."
"It was a shame that it should freeze. The prospects were so good."
"There must have been a world of ducks outside."
"Yes, but now they won't stay with their feed frozen over. They will be on their way south tonight."
"Will they all go?"
"All except our local ducks that breed here. They'll stay as long as there is any open water."
"I'm sorry for the shoot."
"I'm sorry you came so far for so few ducks."
"I always loved the shoot," the colonel said. "And I love Venice." The Baron Alvarito looked away and spread his hands toward the fire.
"Yes," he said. "We all love Venice. Perhaps you do the best of all."
The colonel made no small talk on this, but said, "I love Venice, as you know."
"Yes, I know," the Baron said.
He looked at nothing. Then he said,
"We must wake your driver."
"Has he eaten?"
"Eaten and slept and eaten and slept. He has also read a little in some illustrated books he brought with him."
"Comic books," the colonel said.
"I should learn to read them," the Baron said.
He smiled the shy, dark smile.
"Could you get me some from Trieste?"
"Any amount," the colonel told him. From Superman on up into the improbable. Read some for me. Look, Avarito. What was the matter with that gamekeeper who poled my boat? He seemed to have a hatred for me at the start. Pretty well through, too.
It was the old battle jacket. Allied uniform affects him that way. You see, he was a bit over-liberated.
Go on.
When the Moroccans came through here, they raped both his wife and his daughter.
I think I'd better have a drink, the colonel said.
There is grappa there on the table.
44. They had dropped the Barone off at a villa with great gates, a graveled drive, and a house which, since it was over 6 miles from any military objective, had the good fortune not to have been bombed. The colonel had said goodbye, and Alvarito had told him to come down and shoot any or every weekend.
You're sure you won't come in?
No, I must get back to Trieste.
Will you give my love to Renata?
I will.
Is that her portrait that you have wrapped in the back of the car?
It is.
I'll tell her that you shot very well, and that the portrait was in good condition.
Also, my love.
Also your love.
Ciao, Alvarito. And thank you very much.
Ciao, my colonel, if one can say ciao to a colonel.
Consider me not a colonel.
It is very difficult. Goodbye, my colonel.
In case of any unforeseen contingencies, would you ask her to have the portrait picked up at the Gritti?
Yes, my colonel.
That's all, I guess.
Goodbye, my colonel.
45. They were out on the road now, and the early darkness was beginning. Turn left, the colonel said.
That's not the road for Trieste, sir, Jackson said.
The hell with the road to Trieste. I ordered you to turn left. Do you think there's only one way in the world to get to Trieste?
No, sir, I was only pointing out to the colonel.
Don't you point me out a goddamn thing, and until I direct you otherwise, don't speak to me until you are spoken to.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, Jackson. What I mean is I know where I'm going and I want to think.
Yes, sir.
They were on the old road that he knew so well, and the colonel thought, well, I sent 4 of the ducks I promised to those I promised them to at the Gritti. There wasn't enough shooting to be enough feathers to do that boy's wife any good with feathers. But they are all big ducks and fat, and they will be good eating. I forgot to give Bobby the sausage. There was no time to write Renata a note. But what could I say in a note that we did not say? He reached into his pocket and found a pad and pencil. He put on the map reading light and with his bad hand printed a short message in block letters. Put that in your pocket, Jackson, and act on it if necessary. If the circumstances described occur, it is an order.
Yes, sir,
Jackson said, and took the folded order blank with one hand and put it in the top left-hand pocket of his tunic.
I'll take it easy, the colonel said to himself. Any further concern you may have is about yourself, and that is just a luxury.
You are no longer of any real use to the Army of the United States. That has been made quite clear. You've said goodbye to your girl, and she has said goodbye to you. That is certainly simple. You shot well, and Alvarito understands. That is that.
So what the hell do you have to worry about, boy?
I hope you're not the type of jerk who worries about what happens to him when there's nothing to be done.
Let's certainly hope not.
Just then, it hit him as he had known it would since they had picked up the decoys. 3 strikes is out, he thought, and they gave me 4. I've always been a lucky son of a bitch. It hit him again, badly.
Jackson, he said.
Do you know what General Thomas J. Jackson said on one occasion, on the occasion of his unfortunate death? I memorized it once. I can't respond for its accuracy, of course, but this is how it was reported. Order A.P. Hill to prepare for action. Then some more delirious crap. Then he said, no, no. Let us cross over the river and rest under the shade of the trees. That's very interesting, sir, Jackson said. That must have been Stonewall Jackson, sir. The colonel started to speak, but he stopped while it hit him the third time and gripped him so he knew he could not live. Jackson, the colonel said, pull up at the side of the road and cut to your parking lights. Do you know the way to Trieste from here?
Yes, sir, I have my map.
Good. I'm now going to get into the large back seat of this goddamned oversized, luxurious automobile. That was the last thing the colonel ever said. But he made the back seat all right, and he shut the door. He shut it carefully and well. After a while, Jackson drove the car down the ditch and willow-lined road with the car's big lights on, looking for a place to turn. He found one finally and turned carefully. When he was on the right-hand side of the road, facing south toward the road juncture that would put him on the highway that led to Trieste, the one he was familiar with, he put his map light on and took out the order blank and read, in the event of my death, the wrapped painting and the two shotguns in this car will be returned to the Hotel Gritti, Venice, where they will be claimed by their rightful owner. Signed, Richard Cantwell, Colonel, Infantry, USA. They'll return them all right, through channels, Jackson thought, and put the car in gear.
The End. You've been listening to Across the River and Into the Trees by Ernest Hemingway, narrated by Boyd Gaines. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, you'll find a wide selection of titles in the Clipper catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Clipper audiobook, or for a copy of our latest listings, please call us using the telephone number on the back of this book. Clipper Audio is also represented on the World Wide Web at www.wfhouse.co.uk. That's www.wfhouse.co.uk. Here you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or enjoy narrator profiles and author interviews. Thank you for listening to Clipper Audiobooks.